coming up on Weekend America.
This weekend, I'll be looking for some good takeout.
Everybody that's here for the first time, thank you very much for coming to our food sale. Meet someone that you haven't met before. Don't leave this prison without knowing or having a new friend.
While others will be dining in, I'm Desiree Cooper.
And I'm Bill Radke. Before your weekend shopping trip, how about some historical tips for beating rising food prices?
Americans will get less of the common foods to which they are accustomed. But by rationing, by sharing what we have, and by using our food supply wisely, our nation at war can still support a healthy, active people.
And where do soldiers go to get some weekend R&R?
Our intent is to get the soldiers out of the fight for 4 days at a time, give them a chance to relax, have a bunch of hot meals, hang out at the swimming pool, camel ride, that kind of thing.
The R&R Playground of the Middle East on Week in America after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, welcome to The Weekend. I'm Desiree Cooper in St. Paul.
And I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles. This weekend, some U.S. troops in the Middle East are finally getting R&R. Time to go wild. Except they're still in a conservative Muslim country. This might not turn out so well. And a young couple has just finished walking from Seattle to the Aleutian Islands, and they can't wait to tell you about it later this hour. What are you doing this weekend?
This weekend I might go camping, and then I'll be working at the farmer's market on Sunday.
I'm actually moving to Macon, Georgia.
I'm flying back home to see my mother.
I'm going out of town this weekend to the Indiana Black Expo.
I am going to be joining my family for a planning meeting for a family reunion.
My wife's coming into town from Stevens Point, Wisconsin. We hope to look at some homes. We want to purchase a house.
We own Footloose and Fancy. It's a shoe store. We're having our huge annual sale. I will be there all weekend.
I know I'm supposed to be getting excited about shoes, but it's summer. Barefoot. That's all I care about right now.
I noticed she kept the Footloose and Fancy, dropped the free, which is probably wise for a retailer.
Well, it's a sale.
Those voices, yes, sale. Those voices came from Lincoln, Nebraska, Cincinnati, and St. Paul.
Well, as we go about our busy lives this weekend, most of us never give a thought about the needs of 2.3 million Americans who can't move around so freely because they're behind bars. But as strange as it may seem, some of them are spending their weekends thinking about our needs. At San Quentin Prison in Northern California this weekend, like a lot of weekends, they're having a community service food sale. Now, that's where the inmate groups buy food by truckloads from restaurants, and then they resell the food at a slight markup to their fellow prisoners. And it turns out to be a great fundraiser. All the proceeds go to outside community organizations. As Nancy Mullane reports, it's a chance for inmates to give something back and also to learn how to reintegrate into society.
No one goes to prison for the food, but there's an exception to the drab cafeteria stuff usually served up, Saturday food sales. On these days, inmates raise money for programs by selling restaurant food to fellow prisoners, kind of like a bake sale behind bars. When these events come around, it's like a Thanksgiving feast and 4th of July barbecue all rolled up into one.
It's good for the men because it's a day that they get to eat something that's not on the institutional menu, which is a blessing.
Ernest Morgan is serving a life sentence with the possibility of parole. He was sent to prison when he was 18 for murder.
I was a baby when I came in and basically did all my growing in prison. I'm happy for the strides that I've made as a person and really wish my victim could have seen that too.
5 years ago, Ernest helped start a national program inside the prison called TRUST. The acronym stands for Teaching Responsibility, Utilizing Sociological Training. The men in the program get together every week with a psychologist to practice communication skills and brush up on common courtesies, the things most of us on the outside take for granted, but can be crucial for inmates trying to keep the peace in prison or prove to a parole board they'd be okay if they were let out. The group also holds fundraisers for community groups on the outside, events like today's food sale.
We pick a list of food for the men in the population to order from. They have a $100 limit and they can go wild in that within that $100.
Of course, saving up $100 inside prison can take a very long time. Most prisoners only keep part of the 15 cents an hour they make working in the prison industry. One chicken dinner can cost 100 hours of labor. But that doesn't stop more than 300 prisoners from filling out an order form.
Barbecued ribs, Famous Dave's, fried chicken, fried shrimp, fried red snapper.
and the all-time bestseller, Caramel Apple Lollipops. On the day of the food sale, there's so much food to count and package up. Volunteers from local universities come to help the inmates in the TRUST program. Volunteer Amy Smith is an assistant professor at San Francisco State University.
Often taxpayers and folks in the community think about incarcerated men or incarcerating folks in general as taking from society and drawing from society and the taxpayers. And here's a really concrete example of them giving back in a very specific and powerful way. So I want to be a part of it.
The food sale is also a time for inmates in the TRUST program to socialize with people from the outside, to practice the social graces that can be hard to maintain on the prison yard. But the mingling can be awkward. At first, the prisoners keep to themselves, and so do the volunteers. Ernest, the program coordinator, calls them all together in a big circle.
Everybody that's here for the first time, thank you very much for coming to our food sale. Meet someone that you haven't met before. Don't leave this prison without knowing or having a new friend.
When a big red truck with Famous Dave's Barbecue written on the side pulls into the prison yard, the smell of barbecue chicken and ribs fills the air, and that's when the teamwork kicks in.
Oh, food!
You know what? We're going to have to set all these up?
Yeah, on the table.
Start a line.
Inmates and students form a long line like a bucket brigade and pass hot aluminum trays with greasy juice dripping onto the tables.
Oh, my God, it's hot!
For hours, the incarcerated men and free students work side by side. They count chicken wings and chocolate bars. Prisoners teach students handshakes and ask questions about dating on the outside.
When you go out to eat, does the man pay or the woman pay, or do you share 50-50?
I'd say 50-50.
But that's coming from a youngin, so...
And I agree.
And there's lots of please this and thank you that, words the TRUST program emphasizes in its training.
Can you two grab another table, please, and put it right here? Beans, potato salad, muffin. Outstanding. We're rolling.
Outside the center, prisoners are waiting not so patiently to get their food.
Man.
Madhouse. They are very upset.
Inmate Bernard Moss is guarding the gate separating the prison customers from the food they've ordered. Then he's given the word. It's time to hand out the orders. He stands up and calls out the first names.
Spraggins! Williams! Jeffreyon! Jeffreyon, one more time. I'll throw your ass in the back of the stack. All right. Curry!
2 hours later, the last order is filled. There's a sigh of relief, a look of exhaustion, and a call for a group photo.
On the count of three, say cheesecake.
Man, if I don't smile, they don't know that's happening.
Three, we make cheesecake.
The group raised hundreds of dollars. But more than the money raised is what's captured in this photo. Inmates and folks from the outside smiling, talking together. Volunteer Kim Green, who just graduated from San Francisco State University, says after days like this, her feelings about prisoners have changed.
I used to be very lock them all up, throw away the key, and they've just really made me do a 180 on my perspective.
From San Quentin Prison Yard, I'm Nancy Mullane for Weekend America.
I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles. You're listening to the show about the American weekend. On Saturday, June 9th of last year, Aaron McKittrick and Brettwood Higman started walking. They were a young couple, a biologist and a geologist. They had decided to walk, raft, and ski, mostly walk, from Seattle up through Canada, through Alaska, all the way to the Aleutian Islands. And we talked to them on Weekend America that morning before they left. I asked them whether they were in their right minds. We talked about bears, avalanches, the human foot, and about the environmental issues they wanted to draw attention to, the degradation of nature in the Great Northwest. Well, they did draw attention to that. They photographed the region. They blogged about it. But they also learned a few things. Aaron and Higman, congratulations on making it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You reached the end of the road. You're in Seldovia, Alaska now. I have a million questions. But first, it's really hard to picture 4,000 miles. How far is that?
It's really hard for us to picture 4,000 miles, and we did it. It took us a year.
I figured it out this way. It's like walking from Seattle to New York City to Orlando, Florida, and then walking all over Disney World. And as we know, Disney World is exhausting.
Yes, that's where your feet would really get sore.
All right.
I'm sure.
Only I think there's probably fewer bears in Disney World and more people, though.
Well, for a lot of us, this is we dream about this and maybe fear an adventure like this. So we want to know, what did it do to your state of mind?
For one thing, you have probably more time than anybody ever has in our modern society to just think, to think about anything. And I think that's actually almost some of the biggest effects is like, what if anybody had just, you know, months to think about everything?
And we stayed in, you know, inner city apartments, trailers. We stayed in remote homesteads, you know, people who ate black bear as a major piece of their diet. And it gave us an opportunity to not only talk about that, but to see all these different lifestyles. And I think we have a really different picture right now of where we want to be in Soldovia, as it turns out, than we did when we started this trip.
What have you learned?
There's a freedom that comes with the confidence that you can figure out whatever situation you're in with whatever you happen to have. There was one incident near the very end of the trip when we had gone down to the beach to cook some dinner and left our stuff all set up just 100 yards away and came back, and a bear had destroyed it, completely shredded the tent, and, you know, even put a dent in our credit card, passports. And, you know, I think that once you're confident that basically you can figure it out, whatever comes up, then, you know, I think we can do that in the rest of our lives, too.
So when you left, you gave away your stuff, you left your home. What does home mean to the two of you now?
Well, for a long time, home was that little, like, you know, 1 pound, 8x8 pyramid shelter.
Yeah, people would ask us where we live, and we'd say, oh, we live right here. We'll live somewhere else tomorrow.
Mm. And now, though, we're coming back, actually, to my hometown. I grew up here in Soldovia, and it's out in the mountains by itself. And I think that's going to be our home. It's not, I don't think we're quite to the point where it's home yet, but it's getting there.
Well, Aaron and Brett Wood, thank you for checking in with us over the last year.
Oh, it was really good to talk,
Bill. Thank you. It was great.
Aaron McKittrick and Brett Wood Higman talking to us from Soldovia, Alaska.
You know, I was looking at the blog that they kept during the trip, and one of the things that just blew me away was their diet. I imagined them like eating berries and pulling leaves and jumping into stream and catching salmon by their hands, you know. They were eating junk food.
Yeah, Lorna Dunes, because they were in such a hurry, they were telling me to just cover ground that they didn't have time to live off the land, which sort of blew me away, like, wait, I have a job at a commute. Why are you in a hurry?
Yeah, but since they weren't taking all the food with them, they had to really get to the next stop so that they could restock, which explains why they had to hurry up. But
right,
it doesn't
right.
explain, you know, they used 2 sticks of butter with every meal. I mean, I can't believe they added that to their meals.
Yes, they were burning that much energy, and they called it the tyranny of the food clock. Well, you can get in on their adventures and learn about the state of our environment by making a short trek to weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week. And by Clarkson Potter, publishers of The Splendid Tables, How to Eat Supper, the latest cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat.
Got a bun in the oven? Well, food prices are rising, so maybe it's time you learn how to bake a whole loaf. Coming up on Weekend America.
Thank you.
Welcome to The Weekend. I'm Desiree Cooper in St. Paul. Bill Radke's in Los Angeles. The average American spends about $7 a day on food. But as the economy slows and prices are rising, it's going to be harder to maintain that even as you go grocery shopping this weekend. The cost of food for a basic nutritional meal, a basic nutritional diet, has gone up 7% in just the last year. So more families are turning to food stamps, food banks. They're eating out less. They're cutting coupons, anything to figure out how to stretch those menus. Weekend America's Chrissy Clark is feeling the pinch, too, and she's found solace in an old cookbook. It was written by someone who knew a lot about managing during hard times.
The book is called How to Cook a Wolf. I'm not actually cooking one now. In fact, there were no real wolves harmed in the making of the book or this radio story. What I am cooking is, well, I'll get to that a little later, but let's just say it's sort of a figurative wolf. You know, as in the phrase, there's a wolf at the door, the kind of wolf that comes sniffing around when times are tough and food is hard to come by.
Americans will get less of the common foods to which they are accustomed, but by rationing, by sharing what we have, and by using our food supply wisely, our nation at war can still support a healthy, active people.
Author M.F.K. Fisher wrote How to Cook a Wolf in 1942, during the Second World War. Food rationing programs were just kicking into gear, like the one outlined in this old film strip from the War Department.
Cheese and eggs have been rationed, and the supply of butter is limited to 2 ounces a week.
And you thought things were getting wolfy this year when the price of butter jumped 10%. At least we can still get the stuff at more than a pat at a time. Back in 1942, the wolf was definitely lurking around many American doors. To fight the wolf, the government set up public nutrition classes in churches, schools, and factories.
American women are learning how to prepare foods with greatest economy, with least waste of vitamin content.
M.F.K. Fisher definitely did not attend these classes. Instead, she wrote about the pleasure, the rapture, you can find in food, even under a tight budget or wartime rationing. Here she is talking about why, a few months before she died in 1992 at age 83.
We eat, we all eat. And I early on thought, well, as long as we have to eat to live, we might as well have fun doing it. Should be some enjoyment of food, as it should be making love or keeping warm. That's one of the three basic needs in our lives.
How to Cook a Wolf reads like an issue of Ladies' Home Journal if the editorial staff was taken over by a hungry philosopher, a tipsy and your mischievous, foxy godmother who once kept many lovers. Some of my favorite lines?
Probably one of the most private things in the world is an egg. Until it is broken.
And this suggestion about essential ingredients for any meal.
Use as many fresh things as you can, and what you have decided inside yourself about the dignity of man.
And this bit of advice from the chapter called How to Lure the Wolf.
One way to look your prettiest in the kitchen is to put up a little mirror.
Hide it in the vegetable bin, she says. I love that. How to Cook a Wolf is part cookbook, part essay collection. Fisher shares simple recipes, practical recipes that can be made cheaply. How to make your own toothpaste, a recipe for fried calves' brains, since that part of the cow was cheaper and more readily available under rationing programs. And, of course, instructions for a good but low-cost sherry cocktail. She tells stories, one of an old woman who only lived on $50 a year, but still liked to have friends over for dinner.
To keep up health and morale, whole wheat and enriched white bread are used in sandwiches.
Fisher rejected that piece of propaganda in the chapter How to Rise Up Like New Bread. Rather than buy vitamin-enriched bread, she thought we should make bread that enriched.
Perhaps this war will make it simpler for us to go back to some of the old ways we knew before we came over to this land and made the big money. Perhaps even we will remember how to make good bread again. For probably there is no chiropractic treatment, no yoga exercise, no hour of meditation in a music-throbbing chapel that will leave you emptier of bad thoughts than this homely ceremony of making bread.
Yoga in 1942. She was truly a woman before her time. Of course, to see how Fisher's advice might really work in today's world, I had to make one of the recipes. So I met up with Jeanette Ferrari, another food writer. She and M.F.K. Fisher, or Mary Frances, as she was known, were good friends. We flipped through How to Cook a Wolf.
Let's see here.
And had a hard time deciding what to make. We passed over the aptly named sludge, a mixture of ground meat and vegetables and grain that Fisher recommended for really tight times.
On page 313, she's got this thing called war cake.
Made with bacon grease instead of butter and lots of spices to hide the bacon flavor. And then an odd thing known as
tomato soup cake.
Tomato soup
cake. Yes, which is made with a can of tomato soup. Again, I'm not sure we would want to eat any of these things, but, you know, this is wartime. So
eventually we decided on gazpacho, something we might actually eat. Jeanette read a little of what Fisher wrote so lovingly about the soup.
I always see to it that I have made too much gazpacho. It ripens well when kept chilled, and it is a soul-satisfying thing to drink midway in a torrid morning. It is also one of the world's best breakfasts for unfortunate who are badly hung over. All right, so garlic, sweet pepper, pimento or bell, she says, tomatoes. Two tomatoes.
All in all, $12 worth of vegetables and a little bread that we chopped up.
What do you think she'd think about using a food processor?
You know better than I.
Yeah, I know. I think I do know.
Why would she?
Jeanette thinks she probably would not have approved of the food processor. Fisher's philosophy was that food was not about shortcuts.
Sorry, Mary Frances.
We used one anyway. We decided it was okay because Fisher was not so much a stickler about rules as she was about having a good time while cooking and eating. And we were.
Smells good, doesn't it? Mm-hmm.
But given our country's propensity these days to food processors and frozen dinners and fast food joints that often sell food for far less than it would cost to make it, I asked Jeanette what we can really learn from How to Cook a Wolf.
Even though we are living in a time where we have to conserve everything and that we have to be aware, it doesn't mean that we can't enjoy eating and that we have to think of it as, you know, as the simple pleasures that it can be, rather than cutting back on the elaborateness that, you know, you might wish to have. Basically, she's trying to approach how you can enjoy the frugality that is forced upon us.
And so Jeanette and I sit down to a simple lunch of delicious soup that could easily have served six at $2 per person and enjoy each other's company. That, Fisher said, was the most important part.
Shall we taste it?
Mm.
See?
The best part of cooking?
Tastes pretty good. You can taste the garlic. That's for
with
sure.
A mouthful of cheap, homemade gazpacho soup, I'm
so
Chrissy
refreshing.
Clark for Weekend America.
Would you like some wine? I have wine. With MFK Fisher's permission.
By the way, MFK Fisher would have turned 100 this month. So happy birthday, Mary Frances. You can find a recipe for that gazpacho. It's all at our website at weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, KPCC Los Angeles, and KUOW Seattle, and is made possible in part by the University of Washington Executive MBA Program.
War is hell. But a break from war in the Arab nation of Qatar? Well, now that's a little slice of heaven. Coming up on Weekend America. Thank you.
From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper. This is the part of the show where we play your weekend soundtrack, that music or the sounds you find yourself going back to again and again when you're off the clock. This week's story comes from Holly Maddox, who listens to us in Baltimore on WYPR. The soundtrack to her weekend is Matit Fee by Buckwheat Zydeco. Holly, my feet are moving.
I'm dancing.
Why is Zydeco and why is Matit Fee your weekend soundtrack?
Zydeco is party music. It's dancing music. It's music that people who really love a great rhythm, and Zydeco's got a great syncopated beat, you know, love to hear, and it makes you want to dance. And I've always loved the blues, and when I first heard Zydeco, I thought to myself, oh my goodness, I can finally dance through the blues.
How did you first fall for Zydeco?
I had a friend who had gone to Zydeco dances and asked me if I wanted to go. I had no idea what it was. I'd never even, I don't think, heard the word Zydeco. We went to downtown Baltimore, and I remember an old antiquated maroon brocade wallpaper and a band just pumping out this incredible Zydeco music. But it was dark and dim, and but the room was rocking, and everybody was just gleaming with perspiration and just looking just joyous and enthralled with this music, and I was captivated.
This is Buckwheat Zydeco. Tell us about him.
I think he's got a lot of the traditional Zydeco sound. He's just an expert with the accordion. And that's, as you can hear from this song, you know, the main instrument. I love the French. It pulls in that whole culture of Southwest Louisiana and Eastern Texas, and it's just a stew pot of cultures down there. That's where this music comes from. It's a combination of the Caribbean and the Creole and the Cajun and sort of an exhale from the swamps. It's just really an indigenous American music. It's great stuff. I go to a Zydeco dance, and I don't think there's any such thing as a Zydeco concert because you can't help dancing. And everybody's smiling, big, wide smiles. And it reminds me of the accordion when it opens up. You know, that accordion opens up, and your soul opens up, and a big, wide smile's on your face, and you just feel so great.
Holly, thank you for picking us up with your weekend soundtrack.
Oh, you're welcome. It's my pleasure. That's
right. Holly Maddox listens to us in Baltimore on WYPR. The soundtrack to her weekend is Matit Fee by Buckwheat Zydeco. Et vous, what is the soundtrack to your weekend? And more importantly, what is the story behind it? Let us know while you're listening to all of our weekend soundtracks at weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, I'm Desiree Cooper in St. Paul. Bill Radke's in Los Angeles, but for this next story, we're headed halfway around the world to see how some Americans are spending their weekends in the Middle East, at a U.S. military compound in the Arab country of Qatar. That's where many service members who are stationed in Iraq and Afghanistan go for a little R&R. Since it opened in 2004, more than 150,000 soldiers have flown for a four-day pass. That's the military version of a weekend. So, how do American soldiers unwind when they're still on an army base and they're still in the middle of a conservative Muslim country? As part of our weekend pass series, we sent reporter Orly Halpern to find out.
Day one. From the outside, it's a big beige warehouse, and it blends in with the other military buildings on this U.S. base in the desert of Qatar. But walk through the door, and you're in the Oasis Club, one of the hot spots here in Campus Sailie. People are playing pool, dancing, lining up to order beer. It seems like any bar in America. Except for a few details. Like the fact that it's only 11 p.m. and already last call? And soldiers are only allowed 3 drinks a night?
I had 2 beers and 1 wine.
That's John Vasquez, a tall soldier with a shaved head from East L.A. He's standing glassy-eyed and glum on the edge of the dance floor. He's fresh off duty in Baghdad. It's his first day of R&R. And like a lot of soldiers here, he's not yet ready to stop drinking.
Actually, I decided on the wine because I've been real stressed out lately at work in Baghdad, going on patrols, and the wine is extra strong. It's extra strong.
Alcohol is one of the main attractions on these R&R passes, because drinking is forbidden on most U.S. military bases in the Middle East. But since these soldiers haven't had a drop in many months, their tolerance is low, so the military sets limits. That's not sitting well with Vasquez. He says he's not buzzed enough yet to forget the stress of the job he goes back to in 4 days.
My second tour here. I was supposed to get out in November of 07. And as you see, I'm here in Qatar. They stopped my contract and restarted it, basically. So I have to do another extra year and a half. All I want to do is get out. And that's my whole focus. How about Americans rather than Iraqis, because they're still blowing us up? What's the point? You know what I mean?
The Army's recent stop-loss policy has kept Vasquez in Iraq much longer than he expected. He thinks that's why his commanders let him go on this short vacation, even though 4-day passes are hard to come by. Of course, finding ways to relax battle-weary soldiers is not a new challenge for the military. What's new is how organized the military has become in their efforts.
This is not your father's R&R.
Colonel Dave Cotter is the base commander here at Camp Asalia. He says in the past, R&R during wartime often meant a lot of booze and prostitutes. In 2004, the military tried a kinder, gentler approach and created this R&R compound, a sort of military club med.
Everybody remembers the R&R of the Vietnam era, when the soldiers would go to Thailand or Singapore. It enjoys a reputation of debauchery. Our intent is to get the soldiers out of the fight for 4 days at a time, give them a chance to relax, have a bunch of hot meals, hang out at the swimming pool, camel ride, that kind of thing. It's not an intent to recreate the Sodom and Gomorrah of the late 60s and early 70s.
Day two. Of course, the military doesn't specialize in fun and relaxation, but since that's the task at hand, the people running this program work hard to achieve their objectives. The Chow Hall recently won an award for serving the most delicious food in the military. Soldiers can work out at a state-of-the-art gym, swim in the pool, play Dance Dance Revolution at the bar, eat a steak at Chili's, or see a film at the movie theater. Lieutenant Colonel Carly Mencken is the head of the R&R program. She showed me around some of the facilities, including a chill-out room with deep sofas.
Here is the USO. It's open from 9 in the morning till 5 in the morning. They take their shoes off and put them in the bins here. It's a no-shoes zone, so it's very living room-like. They've got movies playing in the back. You can read books, put your feet up on the chair.
And to complete the family room effect, there are even a few furry dogs hanging around.
That's the military search dog. They're doing training.
Soldiers are encouraged to let their hair down here, sometimes quite literally. I run into one female soldier brushing her waist-length brown hair, who tells me it's the first time she's worn it down in 9 months. Time at this R&R compound is all about the little things, explains some Air Force women I meet on leave from a base in Bagram, Afghanistan.
We needed girl time.
And go shopping.
Did
a haircut.
A room full of purses. Like today, we did nothing, but today was the best day. Today beat yesterday. We slept in.
Oh,
we got our hair cut. She got her nails done. She took what we wanted.
And the showers are hot.
Yeah. You can shave both legs in the showers. Woo! Yeah. Without the hot water running out.
And it's not just women who enjoy a little pampering.
I'm in the spa, getting a facial, massage, and now I'm getting a pedicure and a manicure.
At the spa here on base, I find Sergeant Edmund Burkhold, a 225-pound guy with about 30 tattoos. On duty, he serves in the freezing cold mountains of Kandahar, Afghanistan. But right now, his feet are soaking in a tub of hot water, and a Filipino woman is filing his fingernails.
You can't tell anybody about the pedicure and the manicure. We're going to keep that a secret.
Day 3. One of the exciting parts of the R&R Pass is the opportunity to go off base. Most soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan never leave base unless on a mission. Here, soldiers can go on organized sightseeing trips to the state-of-the-art shopping mall in this nearby city of Doha, where they can slide down the giant ice hill. Or play beach volleyball on the shores of the Persian Gulf. Or they can take a bus tour of the city.
Good morning. Okay, today we are going to show you around downtown. Myself, you can call me Ram, okay? Ram. So guys, let me highlight you the places we are going to visit. First of all, we are going to visit animals market. Camel and mountain goats are there.
Most soldiers I meet are enjoying themselves. But some are disappointed, like Andreas Kramer von Klausbrich, a 44-year-old active duty soldier serving in Iraq. Von Klausbrich is from Fort Polk, Louisiana, and has been in the military for over 20 years. He tells me he preferred the freedom of the R&R passes of the past.
It was a lot more. Okay, you'll be back on the bus in a week. See you later. Here's your hotel. That's it. It's a lot more restrictions on being a soldier nowadays. I guess because a lot of people are too immature. Back then, they cut you loose. You got in trouble, you dealt with it. Qatar? Okay, we'll do a little sightseeing. But we're in a warehouse, no hotel, 3 drinks a day. Ooh. Why is it that we, the defenders of freedom, can't go out and have our fun? Once upon a time, there was such a thing as the Dirty Dozen. You remember how they got their R&R before they went on their mission? They pulled up a truck full of women and wine. That was R&R.
Times have definitely changed. Now, ladies' bathrooms on the base have signs calling on soldiers to stand up against sexual assault. A couple soldiers tell me that sometimes violence breaks out over the tension of a servicewoman here.
There was a guy killed here last month.
It cost the government money.
They got in a fight with another guy over a woman. So the other guy stabbed him. As you notice, there's only
three women.
Or four chicks and 20 guys. The testosterone raises very high.
The Army says that it was an accidental death, but Lieutenant Colonel Mankin, the head of the R&R program, concedes that women have complained about too much attention.
We do get comment cards, and a lot of the girls say there needs to be more girls here because it does kind of suck being a female here because there's a lot of guys. They like to crowd around.
Female soldiers are not allowed to go off base in the company of only one male. When I came here, a military official recommended that I wear loose sweatshirts just to play it safe. Day 4, my last night of R&R. I go to the top-off club on base. It's Friday night, karaoke night. Just as I'm leaving, I see John Vasquez, the guy I met on the first day, who wasn't ready to stop drinking. I ask him if he ended up getting what he needed out of his R&R.
When I was feeling kind of like, man, I wish I was at home doing this instead of feeling halfway buzzed and not being able to get another beer. But as the days went on, it's been all right, you know. I haven't really been looking to get all too drunk or nothing.
Vasquez heads back to Baghdad tomorrow.
I feel depressed right now because I know I'm leaving tomorrow, but I guess my friends back over there need me. I gotta help them. We'll see how that goes. Gotta do my job and bring everybody home. That's all I could do for now.
In Campus Sahelia, Qatar, I'm Orly Halpern for Weekend America.
If I get stoned and sing along, it's a family tradition.
This weekend, base commander, Colonel David Cotter, is hosting a dinner for some departing staff members. He says it's a chance to say goodbye and thanks to folks after they spent a year away from their family and friends. To see images from Qatar and more Weekend Pass stories, go to our website at weekendamerica.org.
Back in the States, the southeast coast is bracing for a tropical storm. Elsewhere, well, here's a look at weekend weather with John Moe.
You don't see much moisture in Queen Creek, Arizona in mid-July when it's 104 degrees. This weekend's an exception. Monsoon Madness features mud volleyball tournament, 100-foot soap and slide, and something called a human car wash. They're going to be so bummed when they find out it was all a mirage and they're just rolling around in sand in the desert. There's people who like hamburgers, there's people who love hamburgers, and then there's Akron, Ohio. Clouds and 88 degrees for the National Hamburger Festival with eating contest, Miss Hamburger, and, not making this up, bobbing for burgers in a pool of ketchup. You know, they tried that with French fries in a pool of hot grease, but it didn't go well. Nothing happening in Placerville, Colorado. That means everything is going according to plan. It's the Nothing Festival, for those who find festivals too festive. No long lines, no admission cost, no events scheduled, aside from thunderstorms and 82 degrees. You know, if the Nothing Festival got popular, it would really be something, which would be a problem. For information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm John Moe for Weekend America.
Coming up, is that a scratch on your cell phone? You know, the newer ones are a lot nicer anyway. Planned obsolescence is next on Weekend America.
Weekend America is supported by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about their weekends at Gather.com. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert. Mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Online at Calvert.com.
Desiree Cooper is in St. Paul. I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles. This weekend, I probably should be repairing a very old and very broken vacuum cleaner. But instead, I'm taking it to a hazardous waste collection site.
You can bring it to my house. I've got, like, I don't know how many in my basement, and they're not that old, but they're all broken.
Yeah, you want it? Because you know, it's like I don't want to fix it. I already have a new one, and it was cheap. You know, in the last few decades, this is how it's gone. American manufacturers have kind of ditched the idea of building stuff to last forever. Now it's out with the old model, in with the new, and by the way, more expensive model. Reporter Eric Malinsky takes a look at where this has gotten us.
My family's like a lot of American families. We buy stuff we don't need, and that causes problems. Like my cousin Dan Grossman, he's got a thing for cars. His wife Gabi used to think it was cute.
That's how he first met me. We both had VWs, and it was the first year that VW came out with that cool key, the new design on the key. Mm-hmm. And he saw my key.
Pickup line.
That was his pickup line.
So you have a new Volkswagen, the new body style Volkswagen.
Yeah.
In the 5 years that Dan and Gabi have been married, Dan moved on from VWs to BMWs. And he's gotten into the habit of buying and selling them every year.
And then all of a sudden he's telling me that he's going out to Staples to get something for work and grab a coffee. And then all of a sudden there are BMW salesmen calling our house. So he lies. He won't even tell me that he's at the car dealership.
Dan feels like he's exercising his freedom as a consumer. But he's also caught up in a conspiracy called planned obsolescence. Manufacturers deliberately phase out styles to get us to buy the same products over and over again. Not surprisingly, it started with cars. Back in the early 20s, Alfred Sloan had just become the head of General Motors. He tried to build a better car than Henry Ford, but that didn't work. Giles Slade is the author of Made to Break, Technology and Obsolescence in America.
So Sloan, in desperation, gave it an overhaul. Made it available in a variety of different models, made it look a lot better than the Ford, and it worked. And he began to develop what was called the annual model change, where they changed the look of the car every year. And then he put it on a 3-year cycle where there were major changes every 3 years, minor changes every year.
It's the job of advertisers and salesmen to convince us that we need these new models. They used to be tail fins. Now it's the latest GPS system, or V8 engine. I saw this relationship play out with my cousin Dan and his favorite salesman.
Walter Budzian. I sell some choice Highline cars, you know, unique cars.
I'm glad that I brought you here because this is, you come in here and you can hang out and talk about cars and you end up buying one, but you didn't go into a dealership and there's no hard sell. It's like an organic process and he kind of, you're like a spiritual guide. Oh, we're having twins, by the way.
Oh, congratulations. Going to crimp your car shopping, is it? Or
no. No, we're building a big garage, so there's going to be a lot more room. Shopping is almost a spiritual activity, at least in America. Brand names give us a sense of identity. Buying new products gives us a feeling of rebirth. And for Dan, a high-end car is a status symbol. You know, in the big picture, I kind of don't really care what people think of me on the highway. It's when I know that I've gotten the approval from another guy that knows that I have, like, you know, the sport premium edition, and it's a specific graphite, you know, whatever metallic paint that those were hard to find. It's like a different kind of approval. Planned obsolescence found its way into every industry, from kitchen appliances to farm equipment. But the real boon was in personal computers. In the 90s, each new computer was faster and faster. But at this point, we don't really need supercomputers for web browsing and word processing. But manufacturers still need to convince us to buy new computers. So they're selling us on style. My cousin Sidhu Nadkarni bought a MacBook last year. And then he saw the commercial for the ultra-slim MacBook Air, and he was smitten.
It took about, like, maybe half a second or so when I realized that it was actually a computer that was coming out of that manila envelope.
Too bad a computer can't disappear inside a manila envelope. Planned obsolescence has been the engine of the U.S. economy for 85 years. But that relationship is looking pretty dysfunctional. Americans threw away 315 million computers last year. We trashed 130 million cell phones. Author Giles Slade.
When we throw it away, it's full of toxins and it goes into the landfill or, you know, it goes to China where it's pulled apart with acid by migrant workers and their kids die young.
We're also running out of raw materials. Oil, plastic, steel, wood, gas. The price of everything is going up.
Oh, see, these are really cute. Maybe I need something like these.
Even my cousin, Rebecca Cascade, who is a total fashionista, is feeling the pinch. She's a new mom, determined to stay in style and not let herself go. I went shopping with her at Barney's, New York.
you read these things about like college costing hundreds of thousands of dollars, and you know, it totally scares you, and you don't want your kid to lose opportunities because you needed like, you know, a new pair of jeans and a new handbag and, you know, the latest cashmere sweater from Habitat and Christian Louboutin shoes, you know, every year.
Like a lot of us, she's becoming more aware of the cost of her shopping habits. But she really needs a pair of 2008 designer jeans.
It's not really need, by the way. It's want. And I think that's, you know, a huge thing about our total consumer retail therapy society right now.
Consumer retail therapy? What does that mean?
Oh, I'm having a bad day. I'll stop in at Saks and get a lipstick. That's like the cheap version of retail therapy. You know, in our country, we're kind of feeling crappy about a lot of stuff right now. It's a really easy way to make yourself feel better than to face up to your real problems.
Corporations feel our hesitation. They factor guilt into the advertising. Rebecca even debated whether she should buy a pair of organic cotton designer jeans. But we can't buy our way out of the problem. We need stuff that's more durable. We need to be less trendy. But habits are hard to break.
Here we are signing.
Rebecca eventually bought a $200 pair of jeans.
Thanks, you too. Ruby, I hope you want to go to University of Michigan and not Yale.
And she returned the jeans the next day. In New York City, I'm Eric Malinsky for Weekend America.
You know what also kills me is the Beta, VHS, DVR, Blu-ray evolution. Like, yes. Every time I get comfortable with a particular technology, it changes and then the prior one is obsolete.
I just want baby pictures, Des. Film, digital, smart card, cell phone, just pick one and tell me what to do. I'm tired.
It's crazy.
This hour of Weekend America is now obsolete. Thanks for joining us for this hour of Weekend America from American Public Media. I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. Now, it's not totally obsolete because you can download a free podcast of the entire program. Just go to our website at weekendamerica.org. It's your weekend. Enjoy it.
Weekend America is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by American Public Media.
On the next Weekend America, we look back on a pivotal event 40 years ago that shaped our nation and still affects us today.
It happened early in the morning. The radio came off and the first thing they said was, "It is a white revolution. There will be no blood expelled."
This weekend in 1968, Saddam Hussein and his Ba'ath Party took over Iraq. That's on the next Weekend America. Join us.